I don't think I've had any terrible, terrible jobs. What about you? What?
I was a thistle picker on the pea line at a local cannery.
A thistle? Say that five times fast. A thistle picker on the pea line? So let's just start there.
Moving Wisconsin forward, one joke at a time, this is Kristen Bry with As Goes Wisconsin.
Yada, yada, yada.
Hello, Wisconsin!
Hello, Wisconsin! Welcome to the 11 o'clock hour of As Goes Wisconsin. I am your host, Kristen Bry, along with Jane Matinere on the board. And if you have watched 60 Minutes or any environmental documentary, you've probably seen the tons and tons of plastics that gets accumulated in landfills and in our oceans. And it's largely because a lot of our plastics can't be recycled. Some can, but a lot can't. But now there is a University of Wisconsin-Madison professor and a Green Bay company that are working together to upscale a new recycling technique that could help keep flexible plastics out of landfills. And so I'm so excited to welcome UW-Madison Chemical and Biological Engineering Professor George Huber to the show to talk about this project and this process. How are you doing, Professor Huber?
I'm doing great, Kristen. Thank you for having me on the show.
So this sounds very nerdy, but also very important. And so I'm excited to talk to you. And before we jump into what the process, the technique is, why is it that so many of our plastics can't be recycled?
Yeah, it's because there's such a wide variety of plastics that we use and produce. You know, we really live today in the plastic age. We use plastic in our clothing, our cars are basically made of different plastics, our computers are made of plastics, everything's packaged in plastics, but they're all different types of plastics that we produce. And then, you know, we put all these colors in your plastics to make our products sell better on the store. And that makes it more challenging to recycle.
And so, because you do think about that. I think about just the packaging of just groceries, how much plastic you go through just in a single grocery trip of the smaller bag to separate your produce. And then that goes into a bigger bag and the packaging on, like, you have to undo plastic to get through some of your food. And so that's kind of some of the stuff that we're talking about when we talk about flexible plastic, right? Like that's the kind of wrappers and packaging that we can't recycle.
Yeah, that's right. There's rigid plastics like your water bottle. And most organizations will take rigid plastics that are at least clear and clean and a single component, but flexible packages like your grocery bags are more challenging to recycle. You're starting to see some stores like Target and Pick and Save starting to set up bins to recycle to start collecting those flexible packages, at least the monolayer flexible package. But most of your flexible packages, several layers. So you put several different packages together. And that makes you use less packaging material, makes your food last longer, your healthcare products stay safer, but it's more challenging to recycle.
So. Absolutely. So then I read this in an article where I found out about the project that you guys are working on. Wisconsin has a big industry for packaging, right?
Yeah. You know, our football team is the Packers, right?
Yeah.
There's a reason why we're the Packers. It's because we're good at packaging things. The first thing we packaged a lot of things was cardboard and glass. Over time, that's shifted to package more and more plastics, package more and more things in plastic, mainly because it's cheaper. Your products last longer. And we don't manufacture these plastics in Wisconsin. Most of them are manufactured in Texas, but there's whole train cars and barges being sent to Wisconsin with huge pellets where we make a wide variety of packaging material. A lot of innovations in plastic packaging, how to package cheese, how to package different materials has really happened in Wisconsin. It's a super important industry in Wisconsin. And I think in the whole U.S., we're the number 3rd state in flexible packaging materials.
Wow. I did not know that. There's always like certain exports, like when you find out that like we're like the number one exporter of cranberries or bovine genetics, and then you're like, oh yeah, it's more than just cheese and brats. So then what is solvent targeted recovery and precipitation?
Yeah, so the challenge with plastics is you have contamination, you have mixture. Okay, so you can imagine one challenge is the shrink wrap you put around boxes. You put that shrink wrap around, there's dirt that gets in there, there's adhesives that get stuck in there. We can take solvents, okay, so we pick a solvent, it absorbs the polyethylene, leaves behind the dirt, we precipitate it out, and then we make a pure plastic material that can then be recycled for the virgin material. Or we have, in these flexible packages, oftentimes they're what's called multi-layer material, so you'll add what's called an oxygen barrier. The oxygen barrier helps your food last longer. Okay, a lot of energy goes to produce the food. So we can pull out the polyethylene, pull out the oxygen barrier. Well, you can't recycle that multi-layer film. That multi-layer film right now has to go to landfill or be burned. So we have a technology to be able to recycle that. It uses a solvent. We design a solvent to basically pull out the plastic we want and leave behind everything else. We then precipitate it, and then we can remake the original packaging material.
That sounds fast, like I said, very nerdy, but fascinating. So basically this can replace the pack, like the saran wrap type things that I keep thinking of, the plastic wrap that used to come on CDs. Of course we don't buy CDs anymore, but that kind of plastic wrap, this could replace that.
Yeah. Or you could remake that flexible food packaging. You know, you buy your potato chips and a multi-layer plastic packaging material. We can pull out different components of that, and then you could remake that that potato chip bag. And right now you can't, that potato chip bag, it's very complex. There's several different layers. There's actually about 20 different layers that go into making that potato chip bag. A lot of science, a lot of technology go into making that potato chip bag, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
That is fascinating. I had no idea. Go ahead, Jane.
So if we just had one design for a bag of Cheetos Puffs that was clear, that just had black printing on it, would that alleviate the need for all of these layers?
Well, you could do that, and companies are doing that, but that will require you to make a thicker plastic material. So you'll actually have to add more plastic to do that. So what the industry does is they add these different layers together to prevent less oxygen, prevent water going on. People like their bags to open up easily, close easily. Printing is very challenging. You know, we like products that look nice on the shelf. You know, yeah. People will pay more for a product that has fancier printing on the shelf. Making it simpler printing will make it easier to be recycled. But we like that, you know, that marketing aspect of the product that we make.
So then the acronym is called STRAP for the process that you guys have created. So it's done. It works. But now basically the next step is to figure out a way to actually commercialize it and have companies use this method?
Well, there's actually a team of researchers here at University of Wisconsin. You know, we have really one of the best engineering schools in the country here who are really working on this. We have a lot of different companies who are focused on this. Actually, the three largest manufacturers of polyethylene and polypropylene are sitting down helping us design this. Amcor, who's in Neenah, Wisconsin, their U.S. headquarters. They're the world's largest packaging manufacturers helping us with this. So there are so many different types of materials to them. We've demonstrated in the laboratory. We've taken our products back to the manufacturer, tested them, remade film with in Amcor. But it took us about 4 months to produce 2 pounds of material.
Okay.
The company wants us to make ton quantities of material. So we can't do that in the university setting. So, well, at University of Wisconsin, we don't have the resources. So we've designed a system at Michigan Tech University to be able to produce 25 kilograms an hour of recycled material. And then after that, you know, we think when we've designed most of that, we built maybe 70% of the system. We hope next year it'll be operational. We can successfully demonstrate this on a larger scale. And then after that, we hope to build a 500 kilogram per hour system in Green Bay, Wisconsin. We have a location picked out. We have customers who want the product, who will be providing us with feedstock. It looks economical. It has lower greenhouse gas emissions, 60 to 70% lower greenhouse gas emissions. You know, plastic, the plastic industry is critical for Wisconsin, and we want to make sure the plastic recycling industry stays in Wisconsin.
So in your experience, obviously, we're talking to UW-Madison chemical and biological engineering professor George Huber. So you were on the science research development side of plastics. When you've worked with plastic companies, like in your experience, is there the good faith desire for plastic companies to find more renewable ways that are still economical to do this? Because sometimes you think of like, as you see those pictures of just like so much plastic and you think of like, there has to, like, why is there not a more of an effort to just use less or find different ways? Like, is that effort there and it's just behind the scenes for most of the public?
Yeah, there is a tremendous amount of effort right now. It's mainly being driven by consumers. Our consumers are demanding more and more recycled material. We really don't think about end-of-life use when we buy products. You know, we don't think about what happens. We go to the grocery store or we go shopping, we buy something, but we don't think about what happens at end-of-life use of our products. And especially with the plastic industry, it's a huge challenge for them. And they are very concerned about some of the challenge. There's legislation coming up. Europe is way ahead of us than I think we are in the US with some of these technologies. But it's a critical thing. I think we need to rethink about plastics is how can we make the plastic industry more sustainable? The companies are investing some money. Of course, we'd like them to continue to invest money and invest in the strap technology and make that here in Wisconsin, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, because I think that's the thing that's exciting about this is not only is the research happening at UW-Madison in Wisconsin, but it's also could directly benefit, you know, a huge industry, as we just said, as far as it being the third biggest state with packaging, to really be innovative and like at the front lines of trying to balance convenience and all of the things that plastics give us, while still being able to not just pollute.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, the packaging manufacturers, they're going back to your comment, you know, making the materials of a single material, you know, that's more easy to recycle, but it's thicker, it costs more, and it's not as good for the environment. So it's hard.
All right. Absolutely. Well, George, this was so much fun. It's super interesting. I can't wait to see how this develops and, you know, potentially in a couple years, see this be a commercialized process. So Professor George Huber works at UW-Madison as a chemical and biological engineering professor. Thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Kristen.
All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back.
And his neighbors think he's helpful and he's sweet. But he never swears and he always shakes your boy.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jade Matinere. Did you know that we did that much packaging here?
No, and actually we didn't have a chance to get him on the air, but Paul called, who works in the packaging industry, and who knew this was so incredibly complicated. He was explaining some of the processes to me and all of the layers, and I just had no idea. And Paul said as well, just like Professor Huber, that packaging is a big industry in Wisconsin. Look at what we learn.
But look at what we learn some days when you're just curious and you're like, we may lose some listeners during this topic, but I'm going to learn something.
I think it's just fascinating. I really do.
And so, yeah, and it's, I think it's so fascinating to take also the leap from, you know, the type of research that happens at our university system, you know, and I think about the different professors that we've had on, the different scientists we've had on, like, I think back to, the professor we had on who was studying mice on Coke.
Oh,
and,
yes.
And the translation that hopefully eventually happens from that research into daily lives. And, you know, and it is a process, right? Like as Professor Huber was saying, being able to take what they've developed and apply the economies of scale, be able to actually quickly, economically produce the amount that they would need to produce for this to be a viable replacement. And like how you take things out of academia and into the mainstream and like the obstacles that come with that. And that's why I thought it was an interesting story as far as what they're developing and also working alongside with like actual private businesses right. that are invested in trying to also see if there's a more viable, sustainable way to do this.
I just am so impressed by the long-term dedication and the patience of these researchers because you don't get results for God. You may never get the end result before you die. And instead of throwing up their hands and saying, yeah, I'm going to do something easier, they just keep at it. I'm really awestruck by that.
Especially as someone who has ADHD and is constantly interested in like multiple things, but never dives too deep in any of it. It's like, it's amazing to me the dedication to one topic that some people can just like have that laser focus in for decades of their life.
Seriously.
Because I'm like, on to the next thing very quickly.
That's why we cover a lot of topics on this show.
Yeah, exactly. So that's not an expert in literally anything.
But you know a lot about a lot of stuff.
I can have a conversation about a lot of different things, but, you know, shallow.
And this is, again, why we bring on the experts.
The experts. So speaking of packaging and Wisconsin, coming to a cereal aisle near you soon, former Badgers JJ and TJ Watt are going to make history next month as the first pair of brothers featured on a Wheaties box.
That is pretty cool. That really
is. So, yeah, it is. It is cool, especially because I think everything, unless they are very good at hiding it, and especially JJ, how good of people they are and how much they give back. It's easy to root for them. But obviously, JJ retired from the NFL last year after 11 seasons and 3 defensive player wins of the year. And then TJ is entering his 7th season with the Steelers and is a 4-time All-Pro selection. And the box hits shelves in August.
A dry cereal eater?
Funny you should ask that, Jane. So we'll just go quickly on this tangent before in our next segment, we're actually going to have a childcare success story and an example of when the community can come together and solve this issue. But before we get to that in the next segment, let me tell you, for growing up, yes. And I haven't bought a box of cereal in so long. Until this week. And so I've gone through, like, I don't have any weird cravings so much as far as the pregnancy stuff. Like,
no,
there's yet to be like,
anything?
Oh, like pickles and ice cream or right. like weird combinations. But I've just gone through phases. Like, I went through a watermelon phase, but I was very disappointed. Like, I've yet to be able to find a good watermelon. I've looked up so many YouTube videos on how to pick a good watermelon, and I feel like I'm following all the advice. And I think they're just getting picked too soon to like meet demand in the grocery stores. So I've gone through that. I now am making my own Italian ice at home because I'm going through like a chewing on ice phase. And I'm also going on, like, as of this week, a cereal phase because my heartburn's back. And so I have to find things that I can like eat, and like milk helps a lot.
Sure.
And so like, and so I looked up like, what can you eat when you have heartburn? And it's basically like whole grains, milk. What else is on that list? I don't know. There's a ton of stuff that just flares it up. So like right now, it's not even that I'm craving cereal so much as it's like, this is one thing that is somewhat healthy that I can eat. If I get cereal that doesn't have a huge amount of sugar in it and milk. And so that is my phase that I am in for at least this week is dry cereal. Like I'm 7 years old.
Well, there's that, you know, that lazy sphincter acting up again.
That lazy sphincter. You know, for a little while I had a reprieve, but it's back and it's annoying. God, it's annoying. It's painful. All right. When we come back, Gabby Serrano, who is the owner and director of the Antico Child Care Center, is going to be here to talk about, because she's basically, this is her year anniversary from when she first started the Antico Child Care Center last year. And the story to how she got it done is a great example of collaboration and partnership with the business community. And so I'm really excited to have you hear more about that story and hear what Shea thinks other communities can take away from that success story. So stick around. This is As Goes Wisconsin. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matinere, and I'm so excited to talk to our next guest. We've been talking about childcare on and off for the last couple months as far as the crisis that we're in and the potential ways to fix it and how it's, you know, it's something that affects everyone, even those people without kids. And yet it feels like a solution that is being left to parents and childcare providers alone, despite the fact that governments and businesses have a lot to gain by actually collaborating. So we are excited to talk about an innovative solution that happened up in Antigo, Wisconsin. So Gabby Serrano is the owner of owner and director of Antigo Child Care Center. How you doing, Gabby?
Good. Thank you for having me today.
Absolutely. So this is your year anniversary, right?
Yeah, it's so crazy to think. As of last week, Monday, Antigo Child Care Center has been open for 1 year already.
That is wild. And so I guess your background is in teaching, right? And teaching like the elementary school children, not daycare, before you started this center, right?
Correct. So prior to opening the center, I was a second grade teacher for the past 9 years. I grew up working in the childcare industry in high school and college, and that is kind of what brought me back into this industry.
So what was kind of the catalyst for you to say, I'm gonna go ahead and open a childcare center, despite the fact that I'm sure there were warnings as far as how hard it could be, or maybe there wasn't any warning. Maybe you just thought you could it would be needed, so there'd be a lot of support for it.
Yeah, actually, my mom was the human resources director of a child care center too, and yeah, gave me plenty of dive in with 2 feet anyways. So throughout COVID, our son lost his spot at a local child care center here, and Antigo is not a large city. And during COVID, we have two licensed group centers here. The other center closed due to COVID and staffing and all the struggles in the industry. And it really brought to light that we don't have many options here in our community. So that I got the wild idea and ran with it since.
Well, that's what I think is so impressive, because you saw places close and yet we're like, well, we got to open another one. Because truly, as far as the people, when you would talk to people in your community, when those, besides including yourself, when those centers closed, like what were people even doing? Were they just quitting their jobs? Were they changing jobs? Like what was the alternative prior to you opening the Antigo Child Care Center?
Right. And I think that's where I've been working very closely with our Economic Development Corporation. And I think it was very eye-opening to a lot of people how childcare and the workforce really go hand in hand. That without childcare options in our area, families aren't able to work or have both parents in the workforce. And it really brought to light that there is that very large need in our community for childcare.
Because in your county, I think I read this, it's basically, is it even with your center open, is it still considered a childcare desert?
Yes. We actually just had a meeting with our county's childcare task force, and Langley County is considered a childcare desert, that there are approximately 650 kids in Langley County and only about 200 childcare slots available.
Wow.
That's including the family providers, not just group centers.
And what is the difference if, for people who are unsure of what the difference between family providers and centers are?
Sure. So a group center is where there are more than seven children in the center, and a family child care provider is someone who does it out of their home.
Got it. Okay. So we're talking to Gabby Serrano, who is the owner and director of Antigo Child Care Center, which is celebrating a year of being open this month. And in the jumping for 2 feet, for face forward, whatever you want to say, as far as taking this on, what was that experience like?
I'll tell you that I would have not been able to do it without all the support of many community members. Yeah. So as I've mentioned, working very closely with the Economic Development Corporation, their executive director, Angie Close, helped set me up with a lot of partnerships and collaborative relationships in our community. And also, the space that I am in is through our local housing authority, and they actually renovated the entire space on their cost to make sure that it was a safe and updated space for the center.
So some of it, I mean, as far as the challenges that come into, it's finding a space, it's finding the people. What were some of the unexpected things that you thought would be easier that were actually really difficult to get done?
I'd say most recently is that the childcare industry lost our state funding. Yeah. Approximately for a small center like mine, we would receive about $6,000 to $7,000 a month. Now, going into this business, I knew that wasn't guaranteed funding. That is still funds that were available from the COVID relief during that time frame. But I guess I anticipated that the pandemic and the highlight that it really brought childcare and the workforce together, that there would have been a greater push for state funding, especially if we know that parents are unable to work if they don't have childcare, that if we're funding public funding for our school age kids, that we'd be more creative in finding a way to fund for our youngest members of our community.
Which is interesting, because I feel like some of, and in times that I've either talked about this or made videos about this, some of the feedback as far as people who do not think that the government should be helping to fund this are saying that some of the obstacles, and I would love to hear your opinion on whether or not you think this is true, is like the regulations that are in, put on trying to start a childcare center or keep a childcare center running. Like how much did you find the actual regulations to be an issue in this process?
The startup process is very tedious. It is definitely a process where I always said that the analogy of my ducks were all floating in a pond, but they had to get in line at the right time. So one step couldn't happen prior to the other. And I think that there are definitely obstacles in the childcare industry of being able to become regulated that could have better help per se. So for example, you can't open your center until you have a building inspection, and you need a commercial licensed building inspector. And there are not many in the state of Wisconsin, and they're extremely expensive. So perhaps, you know, finding the resources to make those people more readily available, or at least a compiled list of people who you could go to. I mean, I think I've reached out to 13 or more people to try to find someone just for that one step in the process.
So there's some credence to that, as far as like, there's ways that we could make this easier for people as they're starting these businesses.
Yes. And I will say that I've worked with our child resource and referral agency, which in my area is Child Caring out of Mosinee, and they provide any technical assistance that you need. So any questions that I need to be answered, they provided like a mock licensing visit to make sure I was ready to go so that I would pass inspection and all sorts of things like that. So there are agencies throughout the state in different regional areas that are willing to support you and help you It just takes that collaboration to make that work.
Got it. Okay. So getting back to your story, as far as, you know, you certainly had the initiative to do this on your own, but did not do it alone, as far as there was agencies involved, there was grants involved. You did, I know you, I think I read that you had part of, you got the Mainstream Bounce Back Grant. There was a GoFundMe mm-hmm. campaign, but even all of that, despite how much support people had, it still wasn't enough. And so you actually took the extra step to get businesses involved. So what does that partnership look like with the community businesses?
Sure. So I guess I always like to use the term that the childcare industry is such a broken business model. So why are parents paying so much money, yet daycare centers need more funding and teachers are making so little? Mm-hmm. So if you think about, you know, say you have a center of, you know, I have 35 kids here and parents pay approximately $10,000 a year. That brings you up, you know, to the $350,000. But that has to also include food, you know, maintenance, operating costs, supplies, materials, things like that, besides paying for staff's payroll. So the average teacher and average early childhood educator in Wisconsin makes approximately $11 to $12 an hour, which is something they could make more down the road at Quick Trip here in, you know, Wisconsin, and receive benefits, which is something a small business is unable to provide. So finding a solution to filling in that broken business model gap of being able to pay my staff what I feel is a more deserved wage, yet still not enough, is something that I was hoping to fill with creating business partnerships in our community.
So how does it work? Like, how does, like, what is the best, like, what do the, what does the business get? What do you, what does the Antigo Child Care Center get?
Sure. So in our we have a tiered model in the childcare industry. Each classroom has a maximum capacity, and making the system a tiered model sets priority to which business gets which spot at which time. So the business signs a contract with us as a partnership agreement. They stipend the center funding on a monthly or quarterly basis, and that gives them priority on our waiting list. So when we first opened the center, each business in our partnership had a time frame. So the first tiered partnership had X amount of days for their employees to sign up so that they received the first spots. And then from then on, now that the center is at full capacity, if an employee of that business signs up on our waiting list, they bump in front of everybody else. So our waiting list is currently at 36 kids. If one of our business partnership employees would register, they would bump to the first spot, which gives them a more realistic time frame. If I can't accept them immediately, maybe I have more of like a 3 to 6 month time frame than an unknown at that point. And from what I've heard through our partnership with the Antigo School District is that that has been a priceless component in the partnership, of being able to at least have a time frame of knowing when they would be able to get into a child care center versus not knowing at all.
Got it. So I guess we're running out of time, but what do you think other communities or child care centers can take away with what you have found to be successful? Do you feel like this is a model that could be replicated at other centers?
Actually, I have had multiple centers, cities, counties reach out to me about the business model, looking into how they could implement it in their area. And it's a little tricky in smaller communities, I definitely say, but it is something that I know has been already implemented in other areas of the state. And I hope that we can continue being creative and finding ways to help fill in that broken business model.
Absolutely. Because I do think, I mean, I feel like there is so much to be gained from the businesses as far as being involved in solving this problem. And this was one of the first stories, at least I heard of, where there was that collaboration and partnership. And so that's why I wanted to have you on the show, so we could bring more awareness of, like, hey, look, There's a way.
They definitely promote it as like an attraction and retention tool for their employees.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, Gabby Serrano is the owner and director of Antico Child Care Center. Thank you so much for spending time with us today. With the minute we have left, is there anything else you want our listeners to know about child care in Wisconsin?
I would definitely say if anybody's interested in even opening an in-home child care center, there's so many resources for you and grants and funding and mentors that are willing to help you get started. So I'd definitely reach out to your local child resource and referral agency for all the support. And it's not as hard as you'd think.
Well, there you go. All right. Thanks so much for your time, Gabby.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, we are going to take one more break. And when we come back, we will wrap up today's show. Stick around. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
What it's all about.
Hokey pokey.
You do the hokey pokey. The hokey pokey. You do the hokey pokey. That's what it's all about.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matinere. Jane, are you familiar at all with Hanlon's Razor?
Is it a philosophical term? Or is it
a philosophical concept that says never attribute to malice that which is adequately explained by stupidity.
Oh, I love it.
And I read this story this morning and all I could think of was that. A quote from the Department of Defense. The Department of Defense is aware of this issue and takes all unauthorized disclosures of controlled national security information or controlled unclassified information seriously. And that does sound serious, but in this case, the government isn't worried about intentional leakers doling out classified docs. Instead, it's concerned about careless typists.
What?
So it turns out that the domain for the country of Mali, so the African country,
right,
which is very, very close.
And it's it's aligned with Russia, right? Mali.
It's very aligned with Russia. Is very close to that of the military. So Mali, the country, is .ml, and the military, the U.S. military, is .mil. So millions of emails meant for military personnel have been going to the West African nation instead. Some containing sensitive information like passwords and high-ranking officers' travel plans.
Oh.
This was reported by the Financial Times. The Dutch entrepreneur contracted to manage Mali's domain has been sounding the alarm about this leak potential for a decade, but his contract is almost up, meaning all emails will soon go straight to Mali's government, which, as you said, is closely allied with Russia.
That's
so
crazy.
Jane, never attribute to malice that which is adequately explained by stupidity, even with our U.S. military.
And this guy's been talking about this for a decade.
Yeah, apparently. But it's just, you know, I have someone in my life who loves the everything can be explained by the higher plan, like the conspiracy, and not that there's not secrets that the government keeps from the general public, but it's just, I always come back to that philosophical thing. Cause you know what I also think about a lot is that quote from Michelle Obama when she was interviewed of when she first got it, like into the White House and was taking meetings and was the first lady. And at first was like so intimidated because, you know, you're sitting with heads of state and people who are heads of departments and people with these incredible resumes. And in that interview, she said, you know, and ultimately you find out that a lot of these people are not that smart.
That's something.
And like, not,
that's something we all knew deep down inside, I think.
Yeah, and like just the I think about that of some of the people that I remember from tech that had very high, like hoity-toity jobs, but it's like you talk to them and you're like, you're not that impressive. And so whenever I hear the conspiracy of how related and planned and coordinated everything is, it's like, have you met people?
Giving them way like, too much credit, right?
You're giving them a lot of credit to be able to pull this off when, like, I've worked at companies and, like, it's hard to get people to walk in, like, one straight line, let alone, like, entire, like conspiratorial, like, taking over the world or trying to keep you under your thumb. It's like most people just, like, exist within the system that they exist in instead of being able to control mass amounts of people and information.
The mastermind.
But masterminds. Masterminds, yes. And so I thought that was concerning, but also kind of funny.
Just make sure you get those email addresses right, folks. That's important.
Well, it's funny because you think about the amount of times people try to send me an email and are so confused of why I didn't respond to them. And it's simply because they spelled my name with an E instead of an I.
Little mistakes.
So Kristen with an E, I will not receive your email if you, and apparently it goes somewhere. So if it's Kristen.Bry and someone has that email because it doesn't bounce and people just don't get a response and are very confused until they text me or somehow get a hold of me and they say, why didn't you get my email? And it's like, well, how did you spell it? And they're like, oh,
whoops,
my bad.
One little thing.
Spell check, people. All right. Well, coming up for tomorrow's show, Greg Bach will be here. And I think tomorrow we're going to play a game, which I'm excited about. I think we're going to dive into the new state fair foods and have some rankings as far as what we would or would not try. So that's coming up tomorrow along with the news. But yeah, and so coming up, well, go ahead, Jen.
I just wanted to remind you that when we talked to our guest last week from the Waukesha County Fair, tomorrow is National Corn Dog Day.
Tomorrow is National Corn Dog Day, and tomorrow is also the first day of the fair.
I think we need to go get a corn dog after the show.
We may have to go get a corn dog post-show. That does sound like something that would give me heartburn, though.
You will never know unless you try.
Worth it.
Yeah.
Worth totally it. I've never been one until now who has to make those decisions as far as like, I'm lactose intolerant, but worth it to have that cheese curd or like, and so now I understand the plight of people who make those trade-offs between how good something tastes and how it's going to make you feel later.
The eternal stuff. Are you willing to make that sacrifice is what it comes down to.
And I feel like for a Waukesha County Fair corn dog, I think I could make that happen. I can't promise I'm jumping on like a theme, like a ride afterwards. But
I'm cool with that.
You know, one of the twisters, what's the one, like the egg crate one where you're flipping around and like the entire thing is moving?
Oh, yeah.
That feels like an immediate way to throw up at this point.
Yes. At any
Absolutely. All right. Well, coming up next is the noon newscast, and then we got Town Call, and then the Todd Alba Show starts at 1 o'clock, followed by Matt Flynn, and then, of course, Devil's Advocates and the Maggie Dawn Show. So still a full day of great topics, great shows, great hosts. But as for us, that'll do it for us today. Thank you for calling. Thank you for texting. Thank you for being part of the show. Thank you to our guests, Dan Schaefer, Professor Huber, and Gabby Serrano. And come back tomorrow when we'll do it all again at 10 a.m. This has been As Goes Wisconsin.